Hi, y'all, and welcome back to the next episode of the podcast. You'll notice I've taken a little time off in the last couple of weeks, and it's just because I've needed to recenter myself, reground myself, and get a little rest. It's a lot of work putting these episodes out, and while I do so love the work, I've realized that every once in a while I'm going to need to take a step back and take a breath so that I can come back even better and brighter than before. So thanks for your patience, and thanks for continuing to listen to the pod. This time, I'm introducing you to Dr. Amy Loden Tiffany, a physician entrepreneur, TEDx speaker, and international best-selling author. But guess what? She's also a mother of five. You know, she spent years trying to fit into the completely unrealistic roles demanded in academic and corporate medicine, and then finally she said, no more. I'm going to create something new. I'm going to create something different. And that's exactly what she's done. And you'll hear a little bit more about that if you're listening to the long form interview. In between all of this, she delivered a TEDx talk, which was called Pregnancy is More Than the Birth of a Child, and then wrote an international best-selling book, The Postpartum Pivot. She's kind of insanely incredible. And I think you'll understand that by the time this conversation is over. So let's get to it. Here's my conversation with Amy Loden Tiffany.
Probably the thing that sticks out to me the most is my husband twice has miraculously been found to have kidney cancer before he had symptoms. Two different types of kidney cancers, and before anyone would look for them.
So my first question for everybody is, you know, if you had to get up on a stage, which you have, and you had to introduce yourself to everybody, how would you do that?
Yeah, it's an interesting question because it's evolved over time, right? First and foremost, I'm a Christian. I follow Christ. I try to follow what his principles. I will also tell you that most of us do it very badly. So don't look to us for perfection because we don't have that as Christians. The second thing I would say is I'm mom of five and a wife to Curtis, and it has been a rocky road to getting here. First two were easy peasy, you know, thought I was doing the corporate mom thing at the time, changed jobs, got pregnant with twins. They tried to kill me. That's what my TED talk was about, is like literally almost dying. And then lo and behold, they're now 6.5 year old boys who are into the whole 6-7 thing that all the youth are going on to, right? And out of the blue, this 2-month-old baby drops into our lap last August. We made a kinship claim to a child who was in the foster system, and okay, well, maybe we are going to be adopting, you know, in the next year or so, or maybe we're just helping a family come back together. We don't know. Right. But just all these beautiful little pieces. And then, oh, by the way, I'm a medical doctor in medical practice, because that would not be boring enough. So I think in answer to your question is I'm somebody who can't make a lot of clear delineations of who I am, because I try to be a lot of different things.
Well, and you just seem like such a wonderful example of abundance, to be honest. Please forgive me. What is a kinship claim? I don't know what that is.
I didn't know either. This is like a whole new thing. So I thought the foster system, first of all, I was blown away. I'm in St. Louis, Missouri. My whole life, I've grown up in church settings, and I've never heard someone talk about foster care. I knew a family growing up that adopted a lot of children, but I didn't know what foster care was. Went to medical school. I'm not a pediatrician, so I never really interacted with it there. And so the very first time I'm interacting with foster system in Missouri was last summer. And I was shocked, because the latest data at that time, I think, was from 2024. And it was like there was 13,000 children in Missouri alone in the foster system. And I was horrified, because I thought, oh my gosh, now multiply that across our country. How many children? It never was on my radar. I never heard anyone talk about it. I didn't know anyone who did anything for foster families. So totally blindsided. And realized that I may not be able to do anything for a lot of these kids, but I can do something for this one. So to answer your question, what is a kinship claim? It's when there is a family member, they may not be very closely related, but down the line of kinship, they're related somehow to the baby or think they are. And in this case, we weren't sure. And now we do know, in fact, we were. But back to those Christian principles, right? Like God says, take care of the orphans, the fatherless, the children, all the people who need help. And this was just so obvious that if we don't do this, we weren't living our faith. And it's been such a blessing. It has been so hard. Well, maybe Frank, right? We were past the baby stage. It was like, how do I put this stupid car seat back in? I don't remember this, right? And like, I kept telling myself, you had twins, you can handle this. This is not that hard, right? But when you have four kids and you're running a busy practice, I was like, how am I supposed to make this happen? So normally there's a pack and play behind me in my office. And, you know, we have all sorts of baby toys at my office. And it's just like this whole thing I couldn't have predicted, but now is the reality I'm living in. And it's good. It's really good.
Holy cannoli.
It's also very messy. Let me be frank. The dishes are piled up in my sink, right? Like there is not a wall in my house that doesn't have something charcoaled on it from some child. But yeah, it's life. It's real. We are blessed. But there's a few days I think I'm getting a stomach ulcer too. So oh, hopefully that's vulnerable and real enough for you.
Is very vulnerable and very real. And I just so appreciate, you know, the story, but also the reality. You're like, hey, this is, you know, it's, I mean, frankly, I think I'm just a little gobsmacked because five kids and then you're like, and I'm a doctor. And I'm
like, oh, there's a whole lot more to this story. If you really want to get into it, I think this is the year God was like, are you legit in your faith or not? I'm now homeschooling my middle schooler. And so she is literally coming to work with me and she does her schoolwork. I do her lessons with her. Then I go see a patient. Then I come back and do lessons, right? Like it is never the story I would have written for myself this year. It's been a really hard year. There's been a lot of crying. There's been a lot of prayers and somebody please help me because I don't see how this is possible. And yet here we are.
Okay. I kind of knew you were amazing, but now you're even more amazing. And I just because I've talked to so many people, just guests, but also friends out in the world, and kind of the unequivocal assessment of the last year has been everybody I've known has been crying.
It's crazy.
And I just think to myself, wow. I mean, people are really struggling in so many different ways, but they're always unexpected ways. It's ways that they just didn't even foresee, couldn't even imagine. And then they're being called to step up to the plate in different places in their lives and release a lot. And I'm a fan of crying. I don't know about you, but I think it's so good. I always feel so much better after I cry.
Yes.
Which is, I know there's a, I don't know, you're a doctor, so you know this. And I love science magazines. So I remember reading once, I don't even know how long ago this was, that your tears, depending on whether they're tears of joy or sadness or frustration, all have a different chemical composition depending on the emotion you're feeling. You probably knew this, right?
This is not something I have remembered. I'm going to blame my perimenopause brain on this and just put out there that number one, I'm dealing with it. And number two, doctors don't know everything, right? So that is fascinating. If you ask an ophthalmologist, they could probably confirm or deny, but I'm just going to put that in the bucket of that is pretty cool.
Well, yeah, I mean, once I learned that, I thought, oh my gosh, that makes sense. So let's say I'm crying because I'm really sad. And then when I'm done, I always feel lighter and I feel better.
Yes.
And so I thought, oh, there's a component of releasing tears. I'm getting those feelings out. You know, yes. They're literally coming out. So
yes, that I believe. But yeah. I don't know that I've seen a tear analysis. That's kind of an interesting idea.
I just thought the body is amazing.
It really is. It really is. And the complexity and the details and all the things that have to go right. Just when you think of even human reproduction, right? Like just to even get a pregnancy and how much goes into that. And I see so many women, most of my clients are females who are working in highly demanding positions across industries. And so many of them have delayed fertility. And then watching the struggle. I mean, it's real. Like, why were we not all told when we were 21, you need to freeze your eggs? Because by the time you're 31 or 41, you're not going to be able to make them, right? Like, that should be just as basic information to health class as anything else. Obviously, there's a lot of implications to that. So I hope I didn't run off half your listeners. But at any rate, there are so many things about women's bodies specifically, and that we should have been told. We should know. They should be basics. And
yeah. Yeah.
It's cool though. The body's cool.
It is cool. I know. I marvel at every once in a while, I just step back and I marvel at it. And I think, man, this, I just how everything comes together and it works in synchrony. And it's just a beautiful system. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you a question. Yeah. When you were a kid, did you want to be a doctor? Did you know?
Yeah, that's interesting. So my parents are both veterinarians. So I knew I liked science. I knew I liked kind of the way systems work together. I loved problem solving, but I didn't necessarily know I wanted to be a medical doctor. In fact, I thought I'd probably be a veterinarian, kind of stay in my homegrown town, work in their practice. It would be a family thing. That all changed for me. My parents actually told me that they said, you have too many questions. You need to go to medical school. And they pushed me to start shadowing some physicians in our community. So when I was 16, I saw my first open heart surgery. And I, to this day, can remember the sounds and the smells and what I saw in that operating room and thinking to myself, this is number one, amazing technology, right? Like the fact that we can do this. And then number two, I want to make sure that nobody ever has to have this surgery again, because this is such a big deal. And that's why as an internal medicine doctor, I specialize in lifestyle and obesity medicine and midlife management and hormones and all the things, because heart disease is the number one thing that will kill women globally and in the United States more than anything else. It kills more women every year than all cancers combined. How many women come in and tell me, I need my mammogram, but they don't understand what's happening metabolically with their glucose, blood pressure, and cholesterol that's putting them on a much more dangerous trajectory. They don't understand how their hormones fall into that, how their pregnancy may have unmasked issues that are going to predict that they'll have early heart disease. So there's just a lot that I do in the phase of life for women in their 30s, 40s, 50s, because of this is such a beautiful window. It's a chaotic, hectic, messy window. I'm living it, right? But there are things you can do right now that may not include medications that can totally rewrite your future, because your pregnancy told you it was going to happen, or your hot flashes are predicting it's going to happen, and we can do something about it. And I am an action taker. If I can change something and do something, I'm going to do it. And this is a beautiful way to be able to do that and prevent women from having these open heart surgeries, which is really my hope. Is I can't fix the world, but I can fix the person in front of me. I'll work with them together. Fix is a bad word, but really connect and help them on their journey.
Yeah, I think what I especially kind of, I don't know, am smitten with, I guess you could say, with how far we've come, but we've also not. Mm-hmm. Gone very far, but we've gone mm-hmm. to a place, we've come to a place where women have more options these days, maybe not through their insurance,
yes.
But you can correct. Certainly, depending on where you live, find someone who does functional nutrition. You can find someone who will mm-hmm. do a deep dive on allergies. Correct. You can find correct. Someone that might be able to figure out gut health mm-hmm. and do a whole panel on that. So we have an array of choices now, which, you know, I think about 100 years ago, and I'm like, right. How do people live? I mean,
right. Even 20 years ago, like this wasn't talked about. I mean, my medical school professors, I mean, they're probably, assuming they're still alive, are rolling over in their offices instead of their graves being like, why are we using all these supplements and all these different things, right? There's not research. But, you know, you don't have to always have a lack of research to say that you have proof of harm. And I think that's been the mistake that we've made in traditional medicine, to say, well, there's not research on this, or the research is small, or it wasn't funded by the right groups or whatnot. And therefore, we just won't accept any of it. We'll downplay it. We say it doesn't exist and ignore it. Or we say it shows harm when it maybe it didn't show it, and the same standard we would hold for other studies. So again, not perfection. That is, I am not the doctor that's going to be paternalistic and tell you that everything follows a certain study. There are really good studies, but it does not, lack of evidence does not equal proof of harm.
Right, right, right. I mean, you know, quite honestly, because going through my journey, I'm live in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And, you know, if you want to find the woo-woo here, whatever people yeah. describe as woo-woo, but my doctor is an MD who's also a naturopath. So she's mm-hmm. very interesting in that way.
Yeah.
And one unusual. Of the things, yeah, that I found really, I don't know, fascinating, but I thought, I wish more people knew this, was you could have your inflammation measured mm-hmm. and then you can understand, okay, what can I do to change this? Is it cortisol? I mean, it could be so many mm-hmm. different things,
right?
But we have tests now that can mm-hmm. figure out why inflammation, especially in women, is so out of control. But the inflammation yes. itself
yes.
can drive heart disease, can drive.
It absolutely does. It's not can, yeah. it does.
Yeah. It's, I just thought, I'm so glad we can figure these things out now.
Correct. It's really shocking to, many of my patients, when they come in, and we use the high sensitivity C-reactive protein as one of our key markers because it's looking specifically at blood vessels, and those blood vessels go throughout your body. And one of the things that's fascinating to my patients, they don't believe me until they see it work for themselves, right? And that's okay. I'm the same way. But I'll tell them, listen, your marker's elevated, and 80 to 90% of the time, this is in your diet. But here's the kicker. Everyone agrees. It's probably not because you ate all of the cookies and the cakes and all the alcohol or the chips. We all know what the quote bad stuff is. We've got that, right? That's not the problem. A lot of times it's you're eating the right foods and they're sabotaging your body because they're in the wrong amounts or the wrong time. And when you start to reassess that, you totally rewrite your story. So there is, to your point, so many cool things, but we have to also understand that maybe the good things are not as good as they seem.
That's so interesting. Is now, because I've read and studied a little bit of Ayurveda and Ayurvedic eating. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, they have, depending on what dosha you are, you know, you can eat certain things at certain times and that'll benefit your body. Is it something akin to that?
I think there probably are some overlaps. I haven't studied that probably as in depth as you have. One of the things I point out to people is inflammation goes hand in hand often with high insulin. And so one of the ways we can back into this is we'll often have our clients use a continuous glucose monitor. They don't have diabetes, so they're having to pay out of pocket for it. It's not cheap, right? But we'll have them wear that for a month and just write down everything you eat during that month and let's align it. And for myself, when I did this, some interesting things came up. I couldn't have a full 8-ounce smoothie, even if I made it myself in my own kitchen without juice. Put all natural ingredients in it, nothing extra, maybe some protein. But like if I try to eat 8 ounces, it's too much sugar at one time for my liver to process. Same thing with the grains. If I tried to eat a serving size of grains, my glucose would go really high. The next couple of days, my joints would hurt. And it turned out I couldn't have a full serving. I could have half. But if I tried to eat a full serving of a whole grain, it actually made me sick. And I started looking into this and looking into why. And certain amounts, there's this whole idea in popular media that we should eat a balanced diet, right? My contention is, and this is mine, a balanced diet only works if you're starting in a balanced place. And there is no such thing as truly balanced. You'll get every MD in the world, their red hairs will go up if you say balance, because like hormones can't balance. None of this is like, there's no balance, right? And I get what they're saying, but that's the word we use in popular lay culture. So I'm using that word for the benefit of our audience who understands what I mean with it. And when we say that you are going to eat a balanced diet, that's assuming everything else was already ready and balanced. So if your body is way too shifted against being able to use carbohydrates well and break them down easily and use them in a way that your body can use energy versus storing this as a fat, you have no business eating a lot of carbohydrates for the time being. It doesn't mean you can never do it. Same thing if you have evidence that you've got too much of inflammation, you may need to look at some of the fats you're eating. Are you really eating the right types of fats? Your body needs fats. Your estrogen needs fats. Your brain needs fats. You can't not eat fat. And that's a big thing that's really confusing and has been for decades. But the key, I think, is how do we get the sugars, the sweeteners, all the artificial flavors and chemicals lower so that maybe our bodies can tolerate a low amount. But I don't believe God signed us to eat red color 6, right? Like it doesn't math. And when the math isn't mathing, I have problems. My middle schooler is probably going to roll her eyes at me in a minute because math isn't mathing is not a thing you're supposed to say, Mom. But I just did. So judge me if you must.
I was just going to say, you know, sometimes my mother rolls her eyes at me. So it's like, it never ends. It just keeps going.
You tell me someday I'll get to do this. Okay, good.
Yes.
Looking forward to it.
Yes. I also was just thinking about how intelligent, funny you are and easy to talk with. So I thought I'd put that out there as well. You have a great sense of humor. So I'm grateful for that. It's so interesting. I learned something about myself. And I think this piece is also important. So this past year in the summer of 2025, I woke up one day and I just was like, I'm going to try paleo as long as I can. I mean, I love vegetables. I love sweet potatoes. I'm just like, I'm going to try it. And I, for about 2 weeks, was really diligent. I started feeling amazing. Amazing. I mean, I just had no problems. My joints started feeling better. I could walk and feel better. And then I had something happen that was insanely stressful and scary. It was basically a shock to my system. I just had this massive shock happen to me that was very, it was devastating. And oh my gosh, the first thing I reached for was carbs. And I just wanted to eat carbs and like stuff my face with carbs. And I realized when I was taking my first bite of that bread or whatever it was, that I was self-medicating with those carbs because I'd formed some sort of attachment where they soothed me and I could feel the soothing happening with the carbs. Now, I do have to get back to my paleo diet, and I've been thinking about that the last couple of days, but food is really powerful depending on what we're putting in our bodies. Yeah. I learned a lot.
Absolutely. Yeah. I don't think anybody would deny that they need to do better. I think the problem we run into is, how do we do better when we're already doing the best we can or feel like we are? We're already overloaded. We're working our full-time job that we get paid for and the one that we don't get paid for at home, right? If we're a full-time mom, we're also being a full-time nanny to the full-time housekeeper to the full-time, like everybody's working two jobs at least. And when you're that chronically stressed, even if you think you have it all together, right? Like no one's going to say they do, but a lot of people are like, I think I'm okay. You're not okay compared to what our ancestors were. Our ancestors didn't have to deal with this kind of stress. Their stress was, how do I not die from the saber-toothed calf that's trying to eat me? Right.
Right.
But, you know, and how do I survive all the childhood illnesses that my kids are getting and unfortunately dying from? Like big things were different, but our biology isn't different. So we've upgraded our lives tremendously from what our ancestors did in terms of our threats and what kills us and what's at risk. But we didn't upgrade our biology. And because we still have that same processing of basic needs of what foods you need, what things are toxic to our bodies, we have to go back and capitalize on that to live in today's world. And that takes a ton of intention and timing. And honestly, it's not a weeks or months thing. It's a years thing of rewriting. How am I going to do this in a way that works for me and my family? So giving each other a lot of grace and being like, oh, okay, you got Chick-fil-A today or Wendy's, whatever your favorite fast food is, right? But you're not doing it every day. And that's a win because you could be doing it every day. So then how do we get it from every day to every week to every other week? Or how do we get it to, we're still going to do it once a week, but we're going to have 50% less, right? Like starting to make those types of decisions can be very empowering for people who are otherwise time and energy strapped.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Thank you for that. Let me ask you the second question, which is, did you grow up in a religious household? If so, what did that look like? Yeah. And has your connection to God or source evolved over time, and how has it evolved?
Yeah, so I did grow up in what many people would call a religious household. There were 8 kids. We were in church every Sunday morning, Sunday night, and Wednesday evening. Every day we talked about God at home and prayed before meals. I think for me, college was a real inflection point of deciding, is this mine? Do I still go with the belief, the traditions, the sacredness that's been handed down to me? And I became a Christian when I was a child and then rededicated my life when I was in college because I really wanted it to be a decision I had made, not a decision someone made for me. I also had to really challenge some of the beliefs that I had and had been taught, whether implicitly or not. What does it mean? And I'll give you an example. I'm not trying to bring politics, but this is from my faith, how I've had to grow. I grew up in a home that was very much abortion is wrong. I went to medical school and I saw second trimester, very much desired babies who didn't have brains. And their mother had to make the decision, do I carry or do I stop? That is a horrible, horrible decision to have to make. And that is a decision no politician should be involved with. That is a decision that a greatly desired child and the loss from that, how that would look. And that particular mother chose to carry and she grieved the entire pregnancy, right? She grieved through it, but she wanted to hold her daughter and have, and they had several minutes before the child passed away. Another mother chose not to do that. And I don't believe that it's my right, duty, or obligation to judge either one of them. My job as a Christian and as a doctor and as a woman is to walk beside them. And that is what I will do. Now, do I believe that birth control should be abortion? No, I don't. I very much don't believe we should use abortion for birth control. But my point is we have to understand that not everything is as perfect as we would want it to be. We live in a broken world. And part of that brokenness is real suffering. And that is an evolution in my thinking that I had to come across. I've never seen, and I'm not an OBGYN, so I'm going to have to give some limits here that I haven't seen what they've seen, right? But I'm not aware of a third trimester pregnancy for sure that you have to terminate to save a mother's life. Could that have happened in second trimester? Yes. My pregnancy that threatened my life happened at 31 weeks. If it had been a month earlier at 27 weeks, that would have been second trimester. I would have died if I had not been in the United States and had an aggressive medical team because preeclampsia with severe features in my story showed up as heart failure. And if I'd had those same conditions in a third world country, I would have died and my twins would have died. No questions asked. Now, I had it at 31 weeks. If it had it at 27, 28 weeks before we get to third trimester, those outcomes are different, right? For babies, for sure. Moms, less so, but there's still risk. Organ failure is a big deal. So when I say this, I hope that everyone can hear. I'm coming at this from a place of a ton of empathy and compassion. People are human beings. I believe they're made in the image of God, and I will honor all of that from life to death. It's also why I don't personally participate in any of the activities that go toward physician suicide. I realize there are people who do that, and I understand many intellectually of why they are, but I also believe those are still sacred people created in the image of God. So walking through both extremes has had to be challenging in my thoughts and in my processes. It's also been challenging in how do we steward our bodies? And for me, this has been a really hard thing because I grew up as an athlete. My weight was never a problem. My first kid, I was living in New York City. I walked everywhere. So I like basically lost whatever weight I gained right away. Right. My second kid, I came back, had a ton of weight gain. And with the twins and all the complications of that pregnancy, I had over 100 pounds of weight gain. And so then you're exhausted. You have four kids. You're still trying to run your business. And you're like, how do I heal in this? And it is really stupid hard. So I just want anyone out there who's struggling to hear, you're not alone. And we need to have these conversations as women, as mothers, as friends, as colleagues, because this transcends so much of everything. And we all want to be our best. But when it came to my faith, I had to say, am I choosing the things that are stewing my body well? And the answer actually was no. I was choosing, in my case, to be a workaholic, to eat out most nights because I was exhausted, to come home, work late, not get sleep, not get exercise, not eating the right foods, not stress. I wasn't smoking. I guess that was my one thing. That's my golden card, okay? And if you're a smoker, there's great ways to stop. We can help you with that too. But that was like the one thing that wasn't on my taboo list of things I should be doing. Like I was definitely being a hypocrite. And I came to the point in my, not only my business, but my faith where I realized I had to redesign. So I left academic medicine and a few years later, I left corporate medicine, started my own thing. And that's why I can do the things that I can today. But remember what I said earlier, my life is messy, right? Like it's not being done perfectly. I pay someone to come clean my toilets because otherwise they never get cleaned. My sink has dishes in it every single night. And it's like, I just cleaned them. How is it dirty again, right? And there's 4 baskets of laundry in my living room when I left this morning. So please don't hear that I've got it figured out. I am trying to figure it out with everybody else. But what I do know is if I hadn't had my faith, I wouldn't have made it to this point. Because God gave me the faith to believe. I don't think I could even have it, had it on my own. It's been, to finish answering your question, the evolution of my thinking is the more I think about the attributes of God, the more humbled I am. The more I think about the perfections and all of the things that I want to aim for, I realize I can never be. And letting that perfection envelop and take over me and help me be my best person is the only way that I think I can bring glory and honor to my creator. So hopefully that answered it for you, but happy to dive in anywhere else.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I just want to, you know, my parents divorced when I was in 4th grade and my father was a workaholic, so he wasn't around a lot. So my mom like really did effectively raise the 3 of us on her own, sometimes while working a night job. So, you know, I just remember the time and in the middle of this, she decided to adopt a dog.
Wow.
Which, you know, named Josh because she insisted on naming them after our ancestors. So Joshua Bush. So Josh.
Okay.
And I just remember the night when, you know, one of us had to set, it was very simple, set the table. Mm-hmm. Then when another one had to clear it up, my mom would be, you know, next to the dishwasher. And I just remember Josh was such a little stinker and so greedy. And he would, you know, my mom would be rinsing the plates, but she'd be putting them in the dishwasher and the dog would be in the dishwasher licking off the plates. And she'd say, you know what? They're going to get sterilized in this dishwasher. And he went like, I don't care.
I just can't. Right.
I just don't care. Like whatever. And I just thought this is funny, but also maybe a little desperate and bad. I can't tell what's going on here, but right. I mean, and no matter what we said to that dog, how many times we put him and we're like, no, it did not matter. That dog was all about whatever atoms of food he could lick off the plates.
Flavors, man.
Yes. Right. Right. And I was like, this is messy, but it's okay with my mom. This is okay. I mean, at some point she was like, I just have to give up this. This fight needs to be let go. Like, yes. It's not going to happen here.
Yes.
But now I have that story about Josh and in the dishwasher. But yes, it is. I can't even imagine, you know, preeclampsia. I remember my best friend had that with her first child, and it is, you know, terrifying, let alone if you're a first time, if you're pregnant for the first time and it's like, right. You have to learn all of this stuff and then bed rest and all of these things. I didn't even consider, you know, thank God you were in the US versus,
right.
You know, a third world country.
Yeah. So terrifying. See, 2022, more than 70,000 moms died of preeclampsia globally. I mean, that's 70,000 children. If they survived, right? Because that's not even guaranteed. But if they survived, they don't have a mother, a biological mother. And so it's a big deal. And what's fascinating to me is that it's a predictor of early heart disease, as are hot flashes during menopause. And women don't know this. Gestational diabetes is another. Within 5 years of having gestational diabetes, half of women will have type 2 diabetes. Half. They don't know. And the frustrating thing is these are preventable problems. Like I used to be mad about it. And then I realized this pregnancy is as frustrating as they were at the time. Right. And that was not a fun process, but they really were a gift because they unmasked what's going to happen in the future. It didn't cause the problem. And that's how I was taught in medical school, is that these things were caused by pregnancy. You get rid of the pregnancy, the problem goes away. Not true. The problem was already there. The pregnancy unmasked it. And now we have to decide it's gone back into hiding. Are we going to do something about it or not? Because it's not going to show up on traditional tests. It's not going to show up in your traditional well woman exam. So how do we get these women identified, help them know that they need help, and then connect them with the people who can help? Because 90-something% of my colleagues aren't even clued into this. We're not taught this in medical school. It's a real open issue.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was just thinking about, I had no idea that hot flashes during menopause can be a predictor of heart disease, because literally every woman I talk to who has gone through menopause has hot flashes.
Yeah. It's a big predictor. It has to do, we think, with instability in the blood vessel lining, which goes back to that inflammation we were talking about earlier. And it does not have to be that this woman goes through without support. Now, some women, for many reasons, decide not to take hormones when they could, and that's legit. And many women decide that they need to do other interventions. I don't have a problem with any of that. I just tell women, talk to someone, know your options, and then make an educated decision for yourself. But again, most physicians don't know that this is an issue. So I would encourage your listeners, if they're looking for information on this, or if you want to pass it on, they need to go to someplace called the Menopause Society. It's a international, it started as North American's Menopause Society. So you may see that name too, but it's now an international group, and they follow all the evidence for midlife women health. Most women don't realize if the average age of menopause is 52, that their changes could start as 10 to 15 years earlier. So as early as 37 years old. And if they just know this, then they can start asking questions and get plugged in. But you want to use, there's a lot of risks for things that are made up, right? We can acknowledge that. And that's where the science gets sticky and where cost comes in and insurance and all the things we hate about healthcare. But they can find somebody who's legit on that website, who's taken extra training beyond medical school, besides nursing school and beyond, to understand this stuff in midlife health for women. And they can find someone who's certified like myself, someone who's interested, but they're at least on a better path than randomly asking whatever guru their insurance approved to see.
Right. Right. Yeah. My father is in the last stages of dementia in a home outside of Chicago. And I was seeing a bioidentical hormone doctor here in New Mexico. And he said, this was fascinating to me. He said, do you have any family members that have, Alzheimer's or dementia? And I said, well, yeah, my father. And he said, okay, we need to put you on progesterone to help you, if you are prone to that, or it will help you not develop it maybe as quickly or whatever. I wasn't clear, but I thought, you know what? I already feel like I'm forgetting my entire life right now. So any help?
Any help's appreciated.
Anything.
What's really fascinating about the memory, and so many women in midlife start to say, I can't focus. I can't, my attention's gone. I can't concentrate. I can't remember like I can. Oh my gosh, I'm losing my mind. Literally. Right. And in truth, I'm sure there are a certain number of women who do that. I don't see that regularly. That is just like maybe one in 15 years type of thing happens, because most of the time it's a hormone or, not just an estrogen progesterone, but an insulin problem. And so insulin resistance, actually, if you look into this, type in Google, you'll find something called type 3 diabetes. And there's really interesting research happening there in terms of insulin resistance and memory loss and how perhaps this is not as clear cut as we thought it to be.
That is fascinating. That is fascinating, because for decades I have been tested as a pre-diabetes, but recently my latest blood work, she said, oh my gosh, you're not pre-diabetic anymore. And I thought, what? I didn't even know you could go in the other direction, but I welcomed it. I welcomed it.
That's a great point. People don't know they can reverse it. You can absolutely influence and reverse it. And that's what we do in our clinic, is really help people do this where we can with lifestyle. Sometimes meds are used, but you can, and you have so much more control than you realize. Insulin resistance is probably at the heart, like we said earlier, of heart disease and kidney disease. So if you can fix that, you fix all the dominoes around it. Yeah. And it is something you can do massive amounts with. You just have to be working with somebody who knows how to do that.
Right. Thank goodness. Thank goodness. Yes. Well, I'd love to ask you the main question of the podcast.
Okay. Tell me.
This podcast is about magic, about miracles. I've interviewed 300 people. I've had every story you could ever imagine.
I bet.
But I ask people, I would so appreciate if you would share, it could be one story, it could be two stories, of something maybe that you witnessed. It doesn't necessarily have to have happened to you. Something that you witnessed or experienced that you thought was magical, miraculous, or mysterious.
Yeah, definitely there's mystery in all of medicine. There's so many times that I don't understand why someone's gotten better. Or the flip side is you're like, how did they not get better? We did everything right. So mystery is always in medicine. I think what comes up for me is how deceived I was finishing medical school and maybe even residency. I trained at one of the best places in the world for residency, and how deceived I was about not understanding what it meant to listen to people and to have them tell me their story and to have them be able to tell me what was wrong with them without a test. And I think it was, it's not one, it's a series of multiple conversations over years of just realizing and being humbled and thinking, you know, these interactions didn't happen coincidentally, right? I do believe that God puts people in my life and puts me in their life to have conversations. And multiple times, would I have made the same decision in retrospect with the information I have now? Probably not. Probably the thing that sticks out to me the most is my husband twice has miraculously been found to have kidney cancer before he had symptoms, two different types of kidney cancers, and before anyone would look for them. But because of the insistence I had that his doctors do what I had learned, which was listen to the man, there's something wrong with him, and look for the problem, being able to advocate for him, he's effectively cured of both cancers. And I don't think that came coincidentally. I think that came from all my patients teaching me to listen to them so that I could then advocate for my husband to be listened to from his doctor. That doesn't mean it won't happen again, right? And there's not more learning to do. But I think the mystery of and the connection and the magic of the connection with each person is seeing the humanity and acknowledging that we're all here together and we're all here in a community. And I see the image of God in each person I care for. And I hope that they can respect where I'm coming from when I am the patient. Being the patient does change a lot for how I practice as a physician.
Oh my gosh, I was just thinking to myself, I've been watching this show that was, you know, filmed in 1994, so quite a while ago. And it's basically about this guy who he lives on, you know, in a really small town in Scotland, and he's the sole police officer. And, you know, there's a motley crew of ragtag residents. And one of them is the town doctor. And it's so fascinating. I was like, oh my God, this is how it used to be. You know, he doesn't have a car. So he'll basically start walking to someone's house. And if someone drives by, they pick him up, they drop him off at the house. And then he spends a few hours with those people, sitting with them, you know, saying, so what's going on? But not only that, getting, you know, let's catch up. What's going on and everything, you know, versus just their, you know, aches and pains or what have you. Mm-hmm. And so is getting like this really rich experience and hearing of their entire life. Right. And I just thought, this is how you find out what's really going on. And we don't do that anymore.
We can't, because doctors don't control healthcare. Insurance companies control healthcare. Hospital CEOs and their staff control healthcare. But that's probably the most frustrating thing in my role is people don't realize that. They think the doctors are in control. And so until the people revolt and the doctors are willing to walk away from insurance, and I say doctors loosely, because it has to be your physician assistants, it has to be the nurse practitioners, it has to be everybody who can walk away does for this to change. But it also has to massively be patients. It has to be legislated. It has to be policy that says you can't have all the expenses for the last 30 years be mostly from admin salaries and admin costs. That doesn't work economically. And so that's, you know, where do we go? I hope that's a future thing where we can have longer appointments. That's why I left the system. That's why I created what I do. Our appointments are 30 minutes to an hour, and we have unlimited appointments in your memberships because we want people to have as close to that as we can. And there have been times where I have looked at someone and said, you know what, I don't know what's wrong with you, but you don't look right. And we're going to do some testing. So let's do that. And I've found early heart attacks. I've found early cancers. I've had all sorts of things because I know these people. And that's what we all want, right? At the end of the day, we want to be listened to. We want to be known. We want to be loved. Those are basic human needs that I can help meet.
Oh, yeah. You know, moving about the world, you know, I've always had this I don't know what it is, but people, strangers will just start talking to me and telling me everything, which is great. Like, I love it. But it has made me realize that so few people in this world feel heard.
Yes.
They do not feel seen.
Right.
And they feel absolutely disposable. And so
yes.
when you have an encounter with someone who is there to engage and deeply listen and be present for you, that is healing in itself. It is so powerful. And I think that's what you're talking about.
It is. They don't have to look like me. They don't have to agree with me. I definitely have people whose politics or religion, you know, they are different than mine. We even talk about it sometimes because you can have a dialogue, right? When you're in that kind of trusting relationship, and they just need to be heard. And I can do that.
That's it. That's a wrap on my conversation with Amy. I really appreciated her capacity for deep listening as well as deep empathy. Her story is really remarkable, and I think hints that maybe there is a better way forward for all of us in the medical arena. That's at least what I'm hoping. If you want to find out a little bit more about Amy, there are going to be all sorts of delightful links in the episode show notes. Be sure to check those out. Please do consider writing a little review or maybe even leaving a rating. Those, you know, 5-star ratings help other people find this little podcast of mine. And I'd be ever so grateful because it just means so much to me that, you know, people appreciate the work that I'm putting out there. Thank you for listening. And here's my one request. Be like Amy. Always understand that your life can change if it needs to, whenever it has to. I mean, we're all taught that you live your life and it's kind of linear and this is what you do. You know, for example, like you go to high school, you go to college, then you get a job, then you work that job, then you retire, etc., etc. Well, life doesn't have to be like that. It can be curvaceous, it can be meandering, it can be so many different things. So in the middle of your life, if you suddenly decide things could be different, things might be better, then take a chance, just like Amy, to redefine what goodness looks like in your life. Always have the belief that you can make something even more gorgeous out of the life that you're currently living. All right, see you next time for the very next episode of the pod. And until then, I hope life is easy, it's filled with beauty, and it's filled with great conversations with people that you really, really love.
Love for you to give a little bit of background, maybe a little bit of a story around your amazing book, The Postpartum Pivot. Okay, great. I'd love it if you'd just take some time.
So you have to understand that after the twins were born, they were in the NICU for 11 weeks, and I had a life and death experience, right? Like, I was being rolled into the operating room, not knowing if I was going to come out alive or if my boys were going to be alive. So that was my rock bottom, scared to death moment that I don't know what the outcome is. And they had a lot of health challenges. Praise God, they're doing great today. But that was a very emotionally turbulent time, and I needed to have an outlet for it. I needed to have a way that I could tell people, you have to listen. This is a problem. And I wasn't sure I was going to make it 5 years or 10 years or whatever because my heart had failed, right? And so I didn't know what my life expectancy would be then. I knew it was predicted to be shorter. And I thought, if there's nothing else, I want people to hear everything I try to tell them in the exam room, but I want to write it down. And I want to do it for moms who are doing the very best they can, and they just can't get it all done because they can't meet these unrealistic, perfect societal expectations. And so I tried to be super vulnerable in the book, Postpartum Pivot. And it's really about how do you take action on the places you can. This is not the right book to give someone who just had a baby, okay? Give her a year, let her breathe. Or if you give it to her, tell her there are parts of this you don't need to do yet, right? Because you're just trying to figure out what side is up and making sure the diaper's not inside out in those postpartum early days, right? So, and remember, I'm living with an 8-month infant right now. So I'm reliving all this. I'm going back to my sister the other day told me, she goes, Amy, it's like in your book where you said this. I was like, oh my gosh, I'm preaching to myself, right? I can't even remember what I said. And so I think that is the heart I have, is it for this book to be in ministry to people. It's not, I mean, I might talk about my faith a little bit in it, but it's really how do you do the everyday things that you have to do in order to be the person you need to be. To your mom, to your daughter, to your sister, whoever the person is, to your neighbor, to your boss. And how do we take science that maybe is a bit behind and turn it on its head? So there are things in there. I've had some of my physician colleagues read it and they're like, this is not evidence-based. I'm like, I know. And it's great because the evidence is behind, right? And standing in that discomfort, but you will find things that I wrote in there that you're like, my doctor's never said that. That goes against everything I've ever learned. And that's okay. All I'm asking you to do is consider what I put out there, consider the evidence, research it more, talk to someone and understand and figure out if that's right for you. Because most of the time I have found conventional science is 10 to 15 years behind what real life is. And there are lots of studies that show what we do in medicine is many years behind, 15 to 17 years on average. And so that means the stuff that was coming out in medical school when I graduated medical school in 2010 is just now being integrated. I mean, that's crazy, right? Crazy. So there are things in there that are absolutely not what people are used to hearing. I do talk about some uncomfortable topics. I talk about what do you do with breastfeeding if it doesn't work? And what do you do if, you know, you've got so much weight gain that you need to think about meds or obesity surgery? Like those are legit conversations to have, but you need to go in and understand what they are. So there's all sorts of extremes. I like to tell people, pick a chapter that makes sense to you.